Welcome to the New York Times Sunday Magazine for Sunday, October 5th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer, and I'll be reading an article titled, "They Celebrated Vigilante Justice on the Battlefield, Then They Brought It Home," written by Matthew Akins and Victor Blue, and another article titled, "Los Angeles Dodgers Risk Alienating Their Fans or Angering Trump." In December 2018, after years in legal limbo, Matthew Goldstein was recalled to active service at Fort Bragg. It had been 2 years since Goldstein went public with the details of his case, in which he shot a man he had taken captive in southern Afghanistan. Convinced that he had killed a Taliban bomb maker and done the right thing for the sake of the mission and his men, Goldstein had refused to quietly resign after his command gave him a reprimand and stripped him of his Special Forces qualification and Silver Star. He mounted a public campaign to pressure the military into reconsidering his punishment, including an interview on Fox News in which he admitted to killing the man and defended his actions. But this strategy backfired. After his on-air admission, the Army reopened his murder case and began aggressively investigating it. Now it was preparing to court-martial him for murder. After years of pressure, Army investigators persuaded several of Goldstein's teammates to give evidence against him. They were trying to build a case that Razul, the man he killed, was not a Taliban bomb maker at all, but an innocent farmer who had been smeared by tribal rivals. Goldstein was facing years in prison, even, in theory, the death penalty. He said the Army offered him a deal: plead guilty to murder and serve 2 to 3 years in Fort Leavenworth. He refused. "I warned them," Goldstein told me. "I said, last time I pulled a lot of punches. This time around, I'm going to hurt you." His only hope, he thought, was to win in the court of public opinion. But he had a problem. His main advocate in Congress, Duncan Hunter, a Republican from California, was now facing federal charges of embezzling campaign funds. "I needed someone who could pick up that torch," Goldstein said. "I was thinking strategically, how can I undermine the Army's position in that one place that it cares about, the public?" By then, he was divorced and had remarried a vivacious school teacher named Julie, who tirelessly defended her husband in interviews. On December 16th, shortly after Goldstein was called back to face the court-martial, Julie went on Fox News for a segment with one of its rising stars, Pete Hegseth. Square-jawed, well-coiffed, and partial to stars and stripes patterned ties and pocket squares, Hegseth was a leading exponent of the new attitude toward the military that was rising on the right, for the troops, but against the generals. As an infantry officer in the National Guard, he had deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Like many service members, he came away disillusioned not only by the failures of those wars, but also by the realization that both military and political leaders had lied about them. Though he had ardently supported both invasions at the time, he would later describe himself as a recovering neocon. In his civilian career, Hegseth had been active in the Republican Party and held jobs at two conservative veterans groups, where he was dogged by accusations of alcohol abuse and financial mismanagement. But by 2014, he had started appearing on Fox News, where he quickly found his stride, speaking to a conservative audience that had lost trust in the military establishment, a historic shift that outsiders like Hegseth would leverage in their climb to power. Within the Republican base, a new ecosystem had emerged of outspoken veterans, one that was fusing with the movement around President Trump. As podcasters and motivational coaches, tactical trainers, and small arms manufacturers, they served a civilian market fascinated with survivalism, paramilitary gear, and special operations. An unapologetically muscular and masculine vision of American power was resurgent, and in this world, the operator was the apex predator. From his platform on Fox News and in his best-selling books, Hegseth linked his criticisms of the military to a broader culture war. A feckless elite had emasculated the military and made it woke and weak, as he put in his book, The War on Warriors, by forcing it to accommodate gender and racial diversity in the face of the grim necessities of warfare, which had always been won by red-blooded American men. The same woke generals and politicians, he argued, had hamstrung American soldiers on the battlefield with excessive rules and overzealous lawyers from the Judge Advocate General's Corps, or JAGS. Hegseth claimed to have seen it in his own deployments. "I was tasked with releasing Iraqi men who we knew had American blood on their hands," he wrote. "The Jagoff lawyers told us we had to do it." Hegseth suggested that he had thought about vigilante killings. "Did we think about taking justice into our own hands? Sure we did." The position of the secretary, described in his book and to our troops today, reflects the importance of empowering our warriors and ensuring they never hesitate to close with and destroy the enemy, the Pentagon's chief spokesperson, Sean Parnell, said in response to a request for comment for this article. An ardent evangelical Christian, Hegseth described the war as a battle between good and evil. Defending Goldstein, an operator accused of crossing a legal line in combat, was a natural cause for him. When Julie went on his show, he encouraged her to summarize the case and then asked how their family was holding up. "We have a newborn baby," she answered, as photos of the attractive couple played on screen. Her husband, she said, was lucky enough to survive war and has come home to be ripped apart by his own government. Hegseth nodded in agreement. "The rules of war get twisted in certain ways," he said. "War heroes are being prosecuted like criminals." He asked her what she wanted to tell the Army's leadership. "What's your message to them?" "We're waiting for someone to do the right thing," Julie said. Goldstein was off screen watching the interview from the studio. Up to that point, he had seen Hegseth as just another talking head. He didn't realize that the host was one of Trump's favorites and that the president regularly watched his show. He had never seriously considered that he would receive a presidential pardon. "No president would have done that," he told me. "The last one was Abraham Lincoln, and it was mostly over deserters." But as he and Julie made their way home, their phones started buzzing. 3 minutes after Hegseth's show ended, Trump posted online that he would be reviewing Goldstein's case. Now that Goldstein had the president's attention, people came knocking. "It's all these New York guys," he said. One was Bernard Carrick, the former city police commissioner. Goldstein said that Carrick, who was convicted of corruption charges in 2009, tried to get him to hire his lawyer, Timothy Parlator, who, unknown to Goldstein, had also negotiated a confidential payment by Hegseth in 2014 to a woman who accused him of sexual assault. Goldstein brushed this off and stuck with his own longtime lawyer, Philip Stackhouse. "I'm fiercely loyal," he said. But another Stackhouse client did make the switch to Parlatori, a member of the Navy SEALs, Chief Petty Officer Edward Gallagher, who was charged that fall with killing a wounded prisoner in Iraq. Parlatori told me he had never solicited either man. Carrick died in May. In much of the news coverage that followed, Goldstein's and Gallagher's name would be mentioned in the same breath, but the two men could not have been more different. Goldstein was a West Point graduate who quoted Sun Tzu. Gallagher had signed up to be a sailor after a night on magic mushrooms. Goldstein didn't think he should vote because he believed that the military should be apolitical. Gallagher had gone to one of Trump's early rallies to wave a SEAL flag. Goldstein's teammates had lied to protect him. It was only under pressure and legal threats from the Army command that some of them had broken. Gallagher had been turned in by his own men, fellow SEALs who accused him of being an abusive, reckless leader with a history of wanton killings in Iraq and Afghanistan. Gallagher countered that his teammates were cowards who were trying to discredit him to cover their own misconduct. "They had this vendetta," Parlatori told me. "What really happened was a guy was accused of a crime that he didn't commit." Gallagher did not respond to a request for comment, but on the podcast The Line, after his trial was over in 2021, he admitted that his team had killed their prisoner. The man was badly wounded and expected to die anyway, so they had practiced medical techniques on him. "We killed that guy," he said. "Our intention was to kill him." To Goldstein, what Gallagher admitted was worlds away from his own case. Goldstein had decided to kill his detainee to protect a key informant rather than engage in the kind of gratuitous violence against a prisoner that Gallagher seemed to have admitted to. "There was no military necessity," Goldstein told me. Gallagher saw his war differently. While he said he followed the law, he wrote in his memoir, The Man in the Arena, that the enemies he fought in Iraq were some of the most savage, evil beings I've encountered in war zones across the world. Eliminating them was an end in itself. Killing those men rids the earth of evildoers. That was my mission and my job, and I felt it was a godly one. That was also how Hegseth and many in his audience saw both Goldstein and Gallagher, good guys fighting bad guys. "You train someone to go fight and kill the enemy," Hegseth said on Fox News. "Then they go kill the enemy the way someone doesn't like, and then we put them in jail." But as Trump publicly toyed with the idea of pardons, fierce opposition arose among the nation's military and political elites. Writing as the head of a group of more than 170 retired admirals and generals who share a belief that fidelity to our nation's most cherished ideals is the foundation of our security, General Charles Krulak, the former commandant of the Marine Corps, stated that pardons would betray these ideals and undermined decades of precedent in American military justice that has contributed to making our country's fighting forces the envy of the world. The debate over the pardons wasn't a partisan one. The battle line ran right through the Republican Party. Earlier in their lobbying campaign, Julie said they had been rebuffed by Senator John McCain, himself a decorated Navy pilot and former prisoner of war. McCain said no, she told me, adding that he had objected to the fact that Goldstein and his teammate burned the victim's body. The vehemence of the pushback showed the role that war crimes played in official discourse as a line that was supposed to separate the United States from rogue states and terrorists. If war, as Tolstoy wrote, is the vilest thing in life, there were essentially two ways to justify it in modern democracies: as lawful self-defense or as a battle of good against evil. A war can be both, as it was in many Americans' minds after the attacks of September 11th. But as U.S. interventions overseas dragged on into chaos and disaster, the country's leaders clung tighter to the kind of legal commitments at the heart of liberalism. And even as we confront a vicious adversary that abides by no rules, I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war, President Barack Obama said as he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. This is what makes us different from those whom we fight. That is the source of our strength. In his speech, Obama had gestured at the irony, critics called it hypocrisy, of accepting the prize even as he was expanding a global campaign of drone warfare and raids by special operations. But the unspoken question was whether it was in fact possible to fight irregular conflicts lawfully, or whether, as the work of political scientists like Stasis Kallias attests, civil wars like those in Iraq and Afghanistan, which are battles for populations and not territory, have coercion and violence against civilians at the core of their logic. Obama was articulating the elite consensus that America's righteousness and lawfulness were inseparable. By contrast, Hegseth argued that our leaders were in denial about the kind of lawless conflicts the United States faced. Should we follow the Geneva Conventions, he wrote? What if we treated the enemy the way they treated us? Would that not be an incentive to the other side to reconsider their barbarism? The debate about the war crimes pardons became part of a larger struggle over legal restraints on the military, one whose implications were as important at home as they were abroad. Later in his first term, Trump would clash with Mark Esper, the defense secretary, and Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and would be thwarted when he sought to deploy active duty troops to suppress protests in American streets. But Trump's first real fight with the military leaders was over the pardons. As Esper would later write in his memoir, the issue wasn't just leniency for war crimes. Trump was short-circuiting the military's legal system before it had a chance to render a verdict. General Milley and I urged the president on several occasions to stay out of it, he wrote. It was unfitting for the commander-in-chief to do what he did, and it caused a lot of ill feelings in the military. In the end, Trump waited out Gallagher's trial, which was marred by the Navy's mishandling of the case. He was acquitted of murder in July 2019, but convicted of posing for photos with the corpse. But in Goldstein's case, the president decided to move ahead before the trial. On November 15th, Trump announced he was restoring Gallagher's rank and pardoning Goldstein and another soldier, Clint Lawrence. At the end of our conversation at his house, I asked Goldstein how it felt to prevail over the army. After the president called to tell him he was pardoned, Goldstein said that he felt grateful but strangely empty. "I wasn't relieved," he said. "It felt hollow." For almost a decade, the struggle had consumed him. Throughout it, he was animated by the conviction that he had done the right thing. But he received absolution from a leader and a public that made no distinction between him and Gallagher, and their case had inflicted immense pain on his teammates and regiment. "I've been alienated from my tribe," Goldstein said. "No pardon can restore that." Even as the violence committed overseas by operators like Goldstein was being celebrated by politicians in the United States, a wartime culture of lawlessness in special operations had come home to roost in another way. A wave of domestic crimes committed by soldiers with the U.S. Army Special Operations Command, many of them around Fort Bragg, home to the command's headquarters and Goldstein's unit, the 3rd Special Forces Group. Some of the former Green Berets I spoke to said that misconduct at home was a result of commanders tolerating rule-breaking by soldiers for the sake of the mission. "You can't accept that type of behavior in one environment and then be shocked when it carries over in terms of how that individual behaves in another," said Anthony Aguilar, a retired lieutenant colonel who served in 3rd Group. In Afghanistan and Iraq, rule-breaking for the sake of the mission could slide into rule-breaking for personal gain. At the end of their deployments, several former operators told me some special forces teams would divide up operations funds that were left over among themselves, handing out cash in envelopes. Others became involved in more serious crime. A federal task force investigating corruption in Afghanistan led to several criminal cases against Green Berets for fraud and theft. At the center of many of them was an Afghan contractor named Hikmatullah Shadman, who got his start as an interpreter with 3rd Group and who had been recommended for a U.S. visa by 4 Special Forces officers. He was charged in one of the largest civil forfeiture cases in the war, in which he eventually agreed to a $25 million settlement. 8 soldiers who served with the Special Forces and worked with Shadman, including 2 officers, were convicted of bribery-related crimes. As the war went on, Special Forces leaders allowed an aggressive ethos to flourish on base that drew inspiration from outlaw biker cultures. With their tattoos, beards, and shaved heads, many Green Berets looked like extras for the popular biker show Sons of Anarchy. Soldiers spent their combat bonuses on the Harleys that filled the headquarters parking lots. Senior officers rode, including Major General Edward Reeder, an influential leader who rose to command both the Special Forces and the Army's Special Warfare School. Through a lawyer, Reeder declined to comment. Reeder, as commander of 3rd Group 2nd Battalion, nicknamed the Bush Hogs, changed its logo to resemble Harley-Davidson. Its motto was, "We do bad things to bad people." Law enforcement had repeatedly warned the military that biker gangs were infiltrating the ranks, including special operations. One internal 2008 report by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives noted that it had received vast intelligence concerning military and veteran motorcycle clubs affiliating themselves with documented outlaw gangs. A group of active duty Green Berets founded what became the Special Forces Regiment Motorcycle Club, whose members attended events on base in their leather vests. One founder was Mark Schwartz, an officer who would go on to lead 3rd Group and retire as a lieutenant general. To start the club, they had to get permission from the head of the Hells Angels in Fayetteville, North Carolina, the rough and tumble city surrounding Fort Bragg, a retired Green Beret named Daniel Silkos. The Hells Angels rode and partied with the military clubs and recruited veterans, and several full-patched members worked at the base as civilian contractors. When you wanted to stand up for a riding club or a motorcycle club, if there's existing clubs in the town, you have to get approval, Schwartz told me. There's a bit of a culture of showing respect. The Hells Angels had a presence. Schwartz said that the purpose of the club was to raise money for charity and encourage camaraderie, and he denied any wrongdoing by it. I was genuinely not aware of any illegal activity that took place while I was commander, Schwartz said. But some Special Forces officers considered the motorcycle clubs and their escapades to be an unacceptable threat to discipline. They were always a problem, said Paul Tulin, a former 3rd Group officer who retired as a lieutenant colonel. Part of the concern was that the clubs, where an officer might be junior to his men, were a parallel world that could subvert military hierarchy. It could just be them, you know, getting drunk and doing something foolish, Tulin said. And now I kind of have that on you. The problem of misconduct in the ranks was compounded by the stress of the war, substance abuse and wounds, especially cognitive ones from repeated exposure to blasts during combat and training. We accumulated an enormous amount of traumatic brain injury, said Mike Perry, a retired Special Forces major who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. A result could be increasingly reckless and violent behavior. I watched the community evolve from commonplace shit, like dudes cheating on travel vouchers, to homicide and human trafficking, he said. It does not go well when an organization that is largely left to police itself fails to do so again and again. To understand the scale of the problem and its connection with specific units, I collected news and police reports of incidents around Special Forces bases and obtained the personnel records of the soldiers involved, as well as vital records and court documents. The picture was one of serious crime at all levels, from young operators to senior leaders. To give just a partial list, two operators with 7th Group in Florida were convicted of smuggling cocaine, and another was accused of shooting up a bowling alley, killing 3 people. A sex and blackmail scandal at group headquarters in Tampa, Florida, ensnared several senior leaders and led to the conviction of a major. in Washington State, the 1st Group commander, Colonel Owen Ray, was sentenced to prison after assaulting his wife at gunpoint. The highest profile incident to date suggests the link between the war and blowback at home. In January, Master Sergeant Matthew Leibelsberger, an active duty Green Beret, blew up a truck packed with fireworks in front of the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas while simultaneously shooting himself. Leibelsberger was a veteran operator who served for nearly 20 years. He had shown symptoms of brain injury and might have been experiencing a psychotic break, but he also wrote that he despaired of his involvement in airstrikes against village drug labs in Afghanistan, which the UN reported killed at least 30 civilians in 2019. The UN basically called these war crimes, but the administration made them disappear, Leibelsberger wrote. I was part of that cover-up. You're listening to the New York Times Magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with the article titled, They Celebrated Vigilante Justice on the Battlefield, Then They Brought It Home. At Fort Bragg, which has been awash in drugs and had the highest rate of fatal drug overdoses of any base from 2017 to 2021, a special operations medic who had been abusing steroids killed himself and his wife. A Delta operator died by suicide while facing charges for a drunken hit-and-run that left four teenagers hospitalized. Another Delta soldier, Master Sergeant William Levine, was shot dead in the woods alongside a former supply unit soldier, Timothy Dumas, who worked with the Special Forces. Both were involved in a drug trafficking ring on base, according to the journalist Seth Harp in his book, The Fort Bragg Cartel, which was published in August. Soldiers from 3rd Group were involved in three separate lethal shootings off base. Another pleaded guilty to paying minors for sex. During one four-year period, 11 of the 70 majors in the group were found to have committed misconduct. One of them was the subject of a revenge porn lawsuit in North Carolina. The problem of crime involving operators was notable enough to prompt questions from Congress. When General Brian Fenton, the head of the military's overall Special Operations Command, appeared before the Senate in 2023, he was asked about the crime wave. So, General Fenton, you know, there have been a series of concerning incidents, suicides, murders, overdoses, drug trafficking arrests surrounding the special operations community at Fort Bragg, said Senator Ted Budd, a North Carolina Republican who wanted to know what the military was doing about it. I want everybody to know that this is not the type of behavior that is welcomed in this formation and is not indicative of an organization in whom the nation has placed a lot of trust, said Fenton, who served as a Green Beret and in the elite Delta Force. I think a key piece in that one is holding folks accountable. Fenton stressed that a vast majority of special operations soldiers served honorably and were not involved in crimes. This is true, and some Green Berets I spoke to said that the problem was about individual bad apples and that the news media had a tendency to overemphasize crimes by operators. The important question, as Fenton noted, is one of accountability. Military officers are taught a basic mantra. Commanders are responsible for everything their units do or fail to do. The people that have done these things have come and gone, Anthony Aguilar said. But the problem still remains. Levine and Dumas are dead. Well, the drug problem got worse. So-and-so went to jail. The murders continue. What is it? It's USA SOC and SF Command and Third Group. An analysis of command assignments show that Army Special Operations has promoted officers even as their units were involved in misconduct at home and abroad. The way we pick senior leaders in the military is by a good old boy system, said Brigadier General Dan Bolduc, whose last role was commanding Special Operations Forces in Africa. And the name of the game is cover each other's ass. Rather than shake up the leadership, the head of Army Special Operations Command, Lieutenant General Jonathan Braga, has selected the last four Desert Eagles commanders from within 3rd Group's ranks. Three of those officers then went on to command the entire group. Two of them, including Colonel Jason Johnson, who commanded the battalion in Kunduz when it bombed a hospital, were then picked for top positions at headquarters. Braga also chose a 3rd Group commander as his deputy and the Desert Eagles operation officer during the Kunduz strike as his executive officer. In September, Braga was nominated by Trump for promotion to head of the Joint Special Operations Command, a position that requires confirmation in the Senate. In response to detailed questions, a spokeswoman for Braga offered a defense of his command's record. We have fully investigated and adjudicated the cases you cover. In each case, we're justified. We have held to account those responsible for any misconduct, Lieutenant Colonel Ali Scott wrote. We are confident our actions stand up to the strictest scrutiny. The term blowback was originally used by the CIA to describe the unintended consequences of covert actions, but it can also refer to the broad repercussions that wars overseas have on the homeland. From the Roman Republic to France after World War II, history contains many examples of democracies that were destabilized by lawless wars abroad. The cost of America's longest war have become apparent. Broken bodies and families, the loss of civil liberties, the growth of the surveillance state, the acceleration of a paramilitary gun culture, crime and corruption in military ranks, popular disenchantment with the establishment, and, most of all, the weakening of the laws and norms that restrain the armed forces. These changes have taken place under both Democratic and Republican administrations, but they have created an opening for a vision of unrestrained violence put forward by leaders like Trump and Hegseth. For many of Trump's supporters, his felony conviction only strengthened their belief that he was fighting a corrupt system. They adopted a new slogan, "I'm voting for the outlaw." Before last November's election, some of the generals who served in Trump's first administration warned that he would try to use the military in illegal and unconstitutional ways were he reelected. Still, Trump regained the White House with the overwhelming support of veterans, and most likely of active duty service members as well, for many of whom the brass has been discredited by the failures of what Trump called stupid wars. He immediately shocked the establishment by nominating Hegseth as his Secretary of Defense, the second in the chain of command, whose confirmation passed the Senate by a single vote. As many of his critics predicted, Hegseth's tenure has been plagued by infighting and blunders, like his divulging military strike plans in a group chat that included a journalist. Throughout it all, Trump has backed him as they work to transform the military under a newly christened Department of War, in a push to avoid the internal opposition from his first term. Trump and Hegseth have purged the military's senior ranks, including its top lawyers. Hegseth swore in his and Gallagher's lawyer parlatory as a reserve commander and special advisor. These moves have sent a chill through the JAG Corps that Hegseth once derided as jagoffs. Parlatori, Hegseth's lawyer, told me he believes that the military justice system was broken and needed an overhaul. "If they are the conscience of the military," he said, referring to the JAG Corps, "maybe you need a new conscience." He dismissed those concerns about the moves as partisan agitators. To replace the Army's top lawyer, Hegseth chose Major General Bobby Christine, a former Republican U.S. attorney and National Guard officer. "We're just slowly eroding the rule of law until it just doesn't exist and everyone's comfortable with it," said Nate Bankson, a retired lieutenant colonel and former special operations lawyer. "It sets the condition for the misuse of the armed forces." This may also include the way the armed forces are deployed at home. Over the summer, Trump succeeded in doing something that military leaders had blocked during his first term, deploying the active duty U.S. military to American cities. In June, he sent Marines and National Guard members in response to protests in Los Angeles, a move that was later ruled illegal by a federal judge. The administration appealed the ruling. He's created a standing task force within the National Guard to deploy to American cities, put armed Guard members on the streets of Washington, D.C. in August, and threatened to send them to Chicago. On September 30th, more than 800 of the country's brass were summoned to a base in Virginia to hear speeches in which Hegseth spoke against stupid rules of engagement, and Trump defended his domestic troop deployments. "We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military," the president said. President Trump inherited a Biden-era military that cared more about woke DEI policies than readiness, Anna Kelly, a spokeswoman for the White House, wrote in a statement for this article. "Now, under this president, our warfighters are prioritized, and our commander-in-chief is using our military for its intended purpose, to protect our homeland from narco-terrorists and other urgent threats. Likewise, he has used his authority to stop homegrown criminals from ravaging American communities and attacking law-abiding citizens." In his expansion on the military's domestic role, Trump has mobilized the language and tactics of the war on terrorism. He has invoked the Alien Enemies Act and designated migrant groups as terrorist organizations, rendering suspects to El Salvador's Terrorism Confinement Center. The military has carried out deportation flights, incarcerated migrants at Guantanamo Bay, and deployed troops to make arrests on the southern border. These public actions raise the question of what is being undertaken in secret by the nation's special operators. Trump has ordered the military to use lethal force against drug traffickers designated as terrorists, a move that legal experts have said amounts to summary killings of non-combatants. In September, the administration announced 3 airstrikes on boats in international waters that they claimed were smuggling drugs to the United States on behalf of a Venezuelan gang. "We smoked a drug boat, and there's 11 narco-terrorists at the bottom of the sea. And when other people try to do that, they're going to meet the same fate," Hegseth said on Fox News after the first strike. This vision of unrestrained power has its roots in the 20 years of conflict waged in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Understanding the secret history of America's longest war is about more than a reckoning with the past. Cases like Goldstein's and the Nurk killings illuminate the connections between a brutal conflict overseas and a radical culture and political shift at home that venerates the vigilante. In this way, shots fired in an Afghan village echo in our present. The next piece is entitled, "The Los Angeles Dodgers Risk Alienating Their Fans or Angering Trump," written by Bruce Schoenfeld. Masked agents of Immigration and Custom Enforcement, or ICE, started patrolling the streets of Los Angeles in unmarked vans in early June. Soon after, the board of the apartments where Vladimir De Jesus Santos lives sent out a mass text. It warned residents that agents had been spotted in Koreatown, 2 blocks away. Santos panicked. A cinematographer and film editor and the son of Salvadoran immigrants, Santos knew that the Trump administration had started an aggressive campaign to detain and deport his city's undocumented residents. His father has American citizenship but speaks English poorly, so Santos wondered how he would explain his status if agents confronted him. His mother has a green card, but the news coming out was that it didn't matter, he said. "My fear and paranoia were ratcheted up 1,000%. ICE's mandate was to seize and detain individuals who were in the United States illegally, or even seemed like they might be. Most of those targeted were Spanish speakers. Within days, forces of resistance mobilized. Karen Bass, the city's mayor, denounced the raids as sowing terror, declared a state of emergency, and imposed a downtown curfew. Jose Gomez, the Archbishop of Los Angeles, wrote on a Catholic website a vivid portrayal of the panic the raids had caused. "People are staying home from mass and work. Parks and stores are empty. The streets in many neighborhoods are silent." Major League Soccer's Los Angeles Football Club issued a statement of solidarity. Angel City Football Club, which plays in the National Women's Soccer League, went a step further, distributing 10,000 shirts that temporarily rebranded the team as Immigrant City Football Club. But Santos's favorite team, the Los Angeles Dodgers, stayed strangely quiet. The Dodgers are arguably the most popular sports franchise in the area and a cultural touchstone for Latinos. Like many others, Santos assumed they would support beleaguered immigrants. Yet as videos circulated of ICE seizing Angelenos, often violently, the Dodgers said nothing, apart from a single supportive Instagram post by a player, Kiki Hernandez. We knew we were being made an example of, not just Latinos, but all of Los Angeles. Ingrid Rivera Guzman, president of the Latino Coalition of Los Angeles, says, and the Dodgers' silence felt complicit. Many Latinos were already angry that the Dodgers, who won last year's World Series, accepted the traditional invitation to visit the White House in April. As the raids intensified, so did the outrage. More than 40% of the Dodgers fan base is Latino, Dylan Hernandez wrote in a Los Angeles Times column that tagged the team as cowardly. But the Dodgers, he continued, couldn't even be bothered to offer the shaken community any words of comfort. A host of Brown Bag Mornings, a popular Hispanic radio show, raised the possibility of a boycott. When the singer Neza came to Dodger Stadium to perform the national anthem and saw so many Latinos in the stands, she sang in Spanish. The discontent apparently made an impact. On June 18th, the Dodgers notified select media outlets around Los Angeles, websites popular with Spanish speakers, and a few larger circulation publications, that they would make a gesture in support of the city's immigrants the following afternoon. Whether it was attempted intimidation or coincidence, a column of unmarked vans drove to the security shack outside Gate A of Dodger Stadium the next morning, before a statement could be released. A driver at the front of the procession requested access to the stadium parking lots so federal agents could use them to process detained immigrants. The parking lots are private property. The agents didn't have an appointment, prior permission, or a warrant, so the guard on duty didn't let the vans enter. They then drove to Gate E, where another guard turned them away and asked that they leave the area. Instead, they remained in a parking lot for more than 3 hours. A crowd gathered, neighborhood residents, anti-ICE protesters, a cluster of reporters. Helicopters hovered, recording the scene. Around noon, the vans finally were escorted from the stadium by the Los Angeles Police Department. As it turned out, they may not have even belonged to ICE. Tricia McLaughlin, a spokeswoman for the Department of Homeland Security, said that DHS personnel were in the stadium parking lot very briefly, unrelated to any operation or enforcement. A day later, the team announced it was contributing $1 million to aid families who were affected by the deportations, though details were vague. We've heard the calls for us to take a leading role, the Dodgers president, Stan Kasten, said in a carefully worded statement that did not mention ICE or immigration, only recent events in the region. Since then, no Dodgers executive has commented publicly on any aspect of the raids. Within 2 weeks, America First Legal, a nonprofit co-founded by the White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, filed a civil rights complaint with the Equal Opportunity Commission, accusing the Dodgers of apparently engaging in unlawful discrimination under the guise of diversity, equity, and inclusion. The Dodgers are a conspicuously multicultural franchise. Herradura Tequila and Estrella Jalisco beer are prominently featured at Dodger Stadium, where mariachi bands often perform live. Images of the most popular Los Angeles Dodger ever, Fernando Valenzuela, can be seen around the ballpark. More relevant, perhaps, Mark Walter, the team's controlling owner, contributed to the campaigns of Barack Obama and the former Chicago mayor, Rahm Emanuel. It hardly requires a leap of imagination for the team's executives to feel at risk of retribution from the Trump administration. "These are unprecedented times," said the former California Senate President Kevin DeLeon, who wrote the sanctuary bill that gave protection to the state's undocumented migrants. DeLeon suggested that the lawsuit against the Dodgers might only be an opening salvo. "The administration has been zealous in its attempts to punish those who seemed critical of or even unaligned with the president and his agenda. What began with law firms that helped prosecute criminal cases against Trump continued with sanctions against universities and cultural institutions, and lately, the Federal Communications Commission's campaign to silence the late-night talk show host Jimmy Kimmel. Why wouldn't the administration demand equity in the Dodgers, as it had from Intel?" DeLeon wondered. "Or, perhaps, a $1 billion settlement like the one requested of UCLA. It's a shakedown," he said. "It's a scene from Goodfellas." We're at the conclusion of this week's New York Times Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Jack Palmer. Thanks for listening. I invite you to join us next week for another informative program. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.